Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants. Since 1985, offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you are not the Texans or the Bengals or the Bears, all teams so flat-out hideous that no one really cares, in other words, if you are not among the very worst, then as the NFL goes these days, you are tied for first. Unless you are among the very few quite hapless teams, 9 weeks into the season, you are having super dreams. If grasping of that concept comes to strike you now as tough, consider this. One Super Bowl this year won't be enough. Joining me now from his home in Virginia to discuss the world's most parity-riddled league is Paul Attner, who writes about the NFL for the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks, Bill. Good to be with you again.
It is perhaps hard to pick what's been the biggest single surprise this year in the NFL, but maybe it's a refugee from the XFL who plays for Pittsburgh.
Tommy Maddox. I think he has to be right up there with the best stories. A guy that was out of the league for 3 or 4 years, Arena, XXL, just really nobody wanted him, including Dan Reeves, who, by the way, drafted him in Denver, tried to get him to play with both the Giants and Falcons and had to cut him both places, and now he's starring for the Steelers. I mean, who would have thunk?
Is this evidence that as you get a little older, it is possible to get a little smarter?
I hope so. I'm still trying. It gives us all hope. You know, I think it's probably indicative of maturity on Mag's part and the fact that this league is quite frankly so nuts right now that there's room for almost anybody, which Maddox is proving. I mean, it just seems like quarterbacks now are coming out of nowhere to become stars, not just players but stars, when it looked like they had no career at all just a couple of years ago.
A fellow who did that not long ago is Kurt Warner with St. Louis, but the star quarterback there now is the guy who started as the third-string quarterback, Mark Bulger. He's got 4 wins in a row after the team started 0-5. Can the Rams come all the way back?
Yeah, I think they can because of just what Bulger has done. And here Bill's a free agent, third-string free agent that, quite frankly, no, I'd never heard of, and I can't imagine many other football fans did either. And all he did last week was throw for 450-something yards, one of the great performances in NFL history. And I think because of what he's done for them, yes, he's given them a chance to come back. And now, you know, we'll have to see if Warner can play up to Bulger's level. I mean, when he got hurt early in the season, he was not playing very well. And it'll be interesting to see if Mike Bartz, the coach of the Rams, will stick with Warner for very long if he doesn't play well, because he knows darn well that he's got a great player in Bulger right now.
The team that beat the Rams in the Super Bowl last time around was the New England Patriots. They came from behind to beat the Bears last weekend, evidence that the Pats are in playoff form.
That was evidence that the refereeing is still going their way, which I'm sure all Patriot fans would love to hear me say, but they certainly got what seemed to me a few breaks from the officiating that game. It's also a game in which they easily could have lost, and I'm not sure what to read in it or not. They're certainly playing better now. The last 2 weeks they've won on the road than they were during their losing streak, and it probably is an indication they're at least starting to crawl their way back. I don't know if it's a full sprint or not, but at least they're starting to show some indication that they're better than they were earlier in the season. But you couldn't get much worse than you're playing midway through the season.
Paul, it is difficult to look at the standings and talk about contenders because, by my count, there are 26 teams that are pretty much in contention to reach the Super Bowl at this point. Does anybody stick out as sort of a step or step and a half above the rest for you?
Hey, Bill, you know, that's NFL math right there, 26 contenders, and that's what they want. They'd like up to 32. I think right now, you know, every time I name a contender, and I do it in a weekly column, I try to point out the best teams, that team promptly loses. So we're gonna go out in this limb that I know is going to break as soon as I get out there. But the Green Bay Packers are playing the best of anybody in the league, and they've got a relatively easy schedule the rest of the way, and I cannot believe that they'll lose many more games. So I would think the Packers are, as we speak, are the best team. But again, that could change as soon as the next game, 2 weeks from now. Other than that, Every time I look at somebody else like Pittsburgh, not Philadelphia, somebody like Philadelphia, they lose right away. Tampa Bay started to play well, and they're not. I mean, it's just the story of the league this year. Nobody is putting anything together other than inconsistency, so I guess that's what it is right now. It's a very inconsistent league.
The 49ers, whether they make the Super Bowl or not, may already have the season's best story with wide receiver Terrell Owens' Sharpie incident. The NFL has already made a rule banning the use of Sharpies on the field, but the Penn Company is cashing in with a new ad that has the coach taking the players' Sharpies away from them before a game. You got to admire the sense of humor, right?
I think it's terrific. I think they made a great use of what I thought was an incident that people made way too much of. I thought it didn't affect the game at all, and it didn't show anybody up. He wasn't making fun of any players or any rivals. He just did something that nobody else has ever seen before. And the league, because it has absolutely no fun and no sense of humor, immediately, like you said, made a rule against it. But at least the Penn Company is going to take advantage of the moment and get some pretty good advertising out of it.
Meanwhile, the league fined Falcons quarterback Michael Vick for wearing red socks underneath his white socks 2 weeks ago. The fine was eventually dropped, which I guess that was something of a surprise given the league's reputation on taking these things seriously.
One of the players said this week that the league has absolutely got themselves into a very conservative situation now where they're monitoring type of behavior that nobody else cares about. To me, it's just it's crazy, and it's taking away some of the personality. They're trying to affect Michael Vick, who is the leading personality, I think, in the league right now, and the last thing you want to do is cut into anything he does.
Can you imagine how Allen Iverson would respond to a rule like that?
Allen Iverson wouldn't be playing in the NFL because he could never pass a dress code.
Fines that obviously are not so easy to make fun of, and we shouldn't make fun of them, are the suspensions and fines the league has handed out to defensive players for so-called helmet-on-helmet hits. Some applaud this move by the league. Others say it's making players less aggressive, and most of the hits the players take to the helmet are by accident in any case. Is the league being too harsh on players being fined for this?
No, the applause you hear is mine supporting the league, Bill. They have to do it. You walk into any locker room in the league, and the first thing you're going to see is a poster on their wall showing the players how to tackle and how not to tackle, and it says, don't lead with your helmet. They've seen it every day. They've been on the job in this league. They've heard about it, and since they started to play football, they know better. And the league knows at least injuries. I mean, they've already got two guys hurt now because of guys getting hit by their helmet, and is also going to potentially paralyze the guy who's doing the hitting.
Absolutely.
And so they need to stop it, and they're going to do it by enforcing these fines and giving them these huge hits until these guys understand to stay within the rules. And that's all the league's telling them. This is the rule. Stay within it, and everything will be fine.
Paul Attner covers football for the Sporting News. Paul, thank you again for joining us, and enjoy the rest of the regular season.
Hey, thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
On Wednesday, the Philadelphia 76ers were bounced out of Boston by the Celtics, 91-81. The following night, Philadelphia came home and beat the visiting San Antonio Spurs, 99-94. Allen Iverson scored 37 points and shot 4-for-5 from the field after returning from an ankle injury in the fourth quarter. Thursday night's win brought the Sixers to 5-3 in the young NBA season, in which Philadelphia is undefeated at home. The victory seemed at least in part to verify the characterization of the club that center Todd McCulloch, a recent arrival from the Eastern Conference champion New Jersey Nets, had presented after a Wednesday afternoon practice in Boston.
Yeah, I feel like so far this team is coming together. We had a nice stretch there where we won a bunch of games in a row, and now we're just sort of waiting for a couple of our key players to come back and help us even further. But in the meantime, we gotta keep getting victories. You got to do it with the guys you have.
The injured include Derek Coleman and Monty Williams, both of whom missed both games this week. I wondered out loud if beginning the season with players on the injured list made Todd McCulloch feel the preseason should be shorter and less devoted to competitive games.
Well, we don't make those sorts of decisions, but it's hard to say. I think sometimes you need those games to help get you ready to go.
That's a dubious conclusion, at least as regards the Philadelphia team. It might be argued that all the 76ers really need to do to get ready to go is to put the ball in shooting guard Allen Iverson's hands and step aside. Iverson is famously averse to practice, has been for years. At times he's run afoul of the coaching staff in Philadelphia for finding other things to do while everybody else is practicing. But he's one of the most talented players in the league, and the team has been built around him, which is why when another new Sixer, Keith Van Horn, also late of the Nets, told me that Philadelphia was getting into a rhythm, I asked him, rhetorically or so I thought, whether it was Allen Iverson's rhythm or a team rhythm.
Oh, it's without question, it's a team. You know, that's what this game is all about. And, you know, our rhythm is, you know, and our chemistry is going to be developed as a team.
To the list of folks who might not quite buy that assessment of the chemistry of the Sixers, you can add Todd McCullough.
I think we do have some role players around Iverson, and he showed that he can be the best scorer in the NBA in terms of winning the scoring championship. And you put pieces around him, guys that maybe don't demand the ball, but guys that know what to do with it when they do get the opportunity. When Allen feels like he's been double-teamed, he needs to have confidence in his other guys to help him out.
Who knows? This season he might have that confidence. Or, more often than not, Iverson, who does not talk to the media on game days and hence was not available to reveal his intentions, might do as he's previously done. He might put his head down and drive through the double team for a spectacular bucket while his four mates on the floor admire his courage, his agility, his bravado. It's too early in the season to even guess whether that will be enough to carry the Sixers back to the NBA Finals. Ahead on Only a Game, a conversation with Larry Platt, the author of Only the Strong Survive, a new biography of Allen Iverson. You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 18 minutes past the hour. Hard times, keep them hard times away from my door. That's apparently the refrain in Yankeetown, where New York Yankees owner George Steinbrenner wants to take a bite out of corporate expenses. The boss is reported to be thinking about eliminating the dental plans of 150 non-ball-playing employees by January 1st. Steinbrenner's past cost-cutting strategies have often eaten away at the benefits of those working in the office rather than those on the field. The money saved by letting the dental coverage decay and fall out would be enough to pay outfielder Raul Mondesi's salary for two games next spring.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Russell's, specializing in decorating for the holidays, featuring silk flowers, ornaments, and everlasting garlands. Established in 1876, Russell's Garden Center, Route 20 Wayland, and Feinman Remodeling of Arlington, striving to create satisfied clients through innovations in architectural design, craft, and management. Feinman Remodeling, 781-643-6269. The New England Patriots try to repeat last January's sudden-death win over the Raiders in Oakland tomorrow. Read more at WBUR.org, click on News, and then on Sports. WBUR supporters also include the Nature Conservancy, working to protect the landscapes, forests, and waterways of Massachusetts for future generations, on the web at nature.org. And the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of nonprofit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. It's 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, reasons to think twice about running an Ironman triathlon even once. But first, fans of pro basketball know Allen Iverson as one of the most talented players in the NBA. But talent is only one of the qualities that convinced Larry Platt that Iverson's story would make a book. The result is Only the Strong Survive, the Odyssey of Allen Iverson. Larry Platt joins me now from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia. Larry, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
You say very early in your book, quote, Now comes Iverson's story, containing the four elements that characterize the generation of black youth that came of age during the Reagan 80s: basketball, rap, dope dealing, and the ethic of getting paid. Isn't that a dangerous and potentially insulting generalization?
I think it's not a generalization in the context of Iverson's story. Basically, Iverson is part of a generation of athletes who have been raised on hip-hop, and that is the culture that is chronicled in Hip Hop Nation. I think we've made the mistake, that is the media, of evaluating Iverson on the basis of being an athlete in the tradition of Michael Jordan and Julius Irving and so forth. You know, remember, at the time that he entered the league, when every other athlete was black or white, was trying to be like Mike, to borrow from the Gatorade marketing slogan, Allen Iverson comes in and he's wearing tattoos and cornrows and taking this demeanor and attitude straight out of hip-hop, which is why in the book Michael Eric Dyson calls him Tupac with a jump shot.
Several times in the book you compare Allen Iverson to Michael Jordan, and it seems to me that compared to Iverson, you regard Jordan as something of a sellout. Is that an accurate characterization?
No, not at all. I have immense respect for Michael Jordan. I just think that he's of his generational moment, just like Iverson is of his. You know, Jordan was very smart and very clever and says in the book something to the effect of, you know, I only let people see what I want them to see because he is his own brand. Iverson just comes at a different cultural time, and I think they're a tremendous contrast in terms of style, and they're a tremendous contrast in terms of basketball itself. You know, Jordan, much more the sort of craftsman who takes 500 shots a day. Iverson, the prodigy, whose genius is much more sort of artistically inspired.
You punctuate your chapters with photographs of Allen Iverson's tattoos, which you write, quote, advertise his ethic. And then there are little captions under the picture, so I gather you got him to comment on each of the tattoos?
That's correct. That is his description of the genesis or meaning of each tattoo in his own words. Because it sort of dawned on me when I asked him in his fifth year in the NBA just what these 21 messages on his body mean. It struck me as amazing that he'd not been asked before by anyone in the media. And he was, as you might imagine, he was anyone who writes these meaningful messages all over their body in permanent marker are actually dying to be explained. So I thought it was interesting, first of all, that he'd not been asked, that the way sports plays out in this country on a sort of daily basis is to almost ignore the fact that this man is littered with messages to us. And I thought it was also interesting that he adopted the tattoos mostly beginning with his rookie year, when he saw his portrayal in the media take on cartoonish dimensions, when he saw himself portrayed as a thug because of who his friends were or because of the incident in his past where he went to jail and ultimately charges were overturned. But he started to not recognize himself in media portrayal, and so the natural inclination was to put on his body who he sees himself to be.
Some of the tattoos refer to Crew Thick, Allen Iverson's so-called posse, and that is a group which I gather his wife wishes was somewhat smaller. How many people is Allen Iverson currently supporting?
You know, it varies, but I think it's upwards of 40 families between relatives and friends. And, you know, for someone who gets such press for being irresponsible, for missing practice and shoot-arounds, his former bodyguard says in the book, in some ways, he's the most responsible person I've ever met because he's taken upon his shoulders the responsibility of raising this entire community. That's laudable, but on the other hand, Nikki Giovanni wrote a great poem called Iverson's Posse. The refrain over and over again is, send your posse to school, Alan. and you hope that he has exhibited growth over his 6 years in the NBA, and you hope that at some point he heeds her advice.
I can understand that sentiment because some of these guys, they get into hotel rooms, they run up thousands of dollars of bills in room service, they trash the rooms, and then they leave it all on Allen Iverson's bill.
That's right. There's a tragic element to this story. You know, I've often described it as Angela's ashes for the American ghetto. There is this underside to it of a young prodigy who, because of the nature of prodigy, has lived a life that is so unlike anything we can relate to, and that includes a life of strange relationships and strained relationships with people who he loves. But from an outsider perspective, when you watch this, you wonder what the equation is, what he gives as compared to what he gets from these relationships.
In Only the Strong Survive, you maintain that Allen Iverson was railroaded by the authorities several times. First, when he was a high school student, there was a brawl in a bowling alley. He was arrested after that. Then in 1997, a speeding in a Mercedes with a gun in the car. And then last summer, at 2 o'clock in the morning, raising a ruckus while trying to find his wife, who he may or may not have tossed out while she had no clothes on, depending on which story you believe. I wonder if you consider yourself having written this book as an apologist for Allen Iverson.
No, not at all. I mean, I think, you know, I haven't shied away from chronicling those events. I am committed journalistically to giving the context of them. It was widely reported, including on the network news, that he may have tossed his wife out of the house naked. On the NBC Nightly News, it was said that, according to published reports, well, the only published report was the transcript of the 911 call from the accuser. That doesn't qualify as professional journalism, it seems to me. So in those cases, I think I've attempted to set the record straight. But no, there's no, you know, I'm committed to providing the context behind these allegations, but not sugarcoating the misdeeds.
Allen Iverson has succeeded by many measures. He's been a most valuable player in the NBA. He's been an all-star. If the Lakers hadn't been quite so good 2 years ago, he might have played on an NBA champion. Do you think he ever will?
You know, it's difficult to say. I think the odds are that he won't because the way he plays the game is so dangerous and so reckless. And he's all of 5'10". They list him at 6 foot, but I've stood next to him. He's all of 5'10", 160 pounds. And he challenges people who are built like Shaquille O'Neal and suffers so many injuries that I think he's not the type of guy, the type of player, who will be effective into his 30s. He's 27 now. And there comes a time, I think, sooner rather than later with someone who plays the way he does, where that catches up with you. So I think he's an amazingly exciting player, and I would never count him out because of his competitive spirit, which rivals that of Jordan's. And I mean that not necessarily as a compliment. I think those guys can compete in an ultimately unhealthy way. But I think time is running out for him, even though he's only 27.
Larry Flatt is the author of Only the Strong Survive, The Odyssey of Allen Iverson. Larry, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Each year, thousands of amateur athletes sign up to compete in grueling 140-mile Ironman triathlons. The sport is attracting more attention, corporate sponsors, and television contracts, as well as participants. Now some critics are concerned that more should be done to protect racers, a third of whom wind up seriously ill and even in the hospital. In recent months, two athletes have died. North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
It's late July, race day in Lake Placid, New York. Athletes whir past as they lean into the turn on sleek racing bikes.
Hey, you guys have done the bike. You've done the swim. One more thing to do today.
That's easy.
Just run a marathon, no worries.
But after a 2-mile swim and 120 miles on the bike, some racers here do look worried. They appear haggard and off balance.
It's not tiddlywinks, as we like to say.
Shane Facto is a spokesman for Ironman USA. The Lake Placid-based company is one of the top triathlon promoters in the country. Triathlons were first organized for elite military groups like the Navy SEALs, some of the fittest people in the world. But now the races are marketed to everyone, regardless of age, regardless of physical condition. And Facteau doesn't deny it.
We don't do any gatekeeping, per se, in keeping people out because, you know, I know people who have done the race who have brain tumors right out of cancer treatment. I mean, crazy.
Across the country, more than 20,000 amateur athletes sign up for Ironman races each year. They pay hundreds of dollars apiece for the privilege of swimming 2 miles, biking 120 miles, and running a full 26-mile marathon. Facteau says it's a chance for people to test their courage and stamina. But for many, says Dr. Michael Pond, this test will end in the hospital.
Clearly, there's people who shouldn't race. This year, we had a guy who had a pacemaker, heart condition, had chest pain, and not quite right.
Pond is an emergency room doctor who's worked as chief physician for the Lake Placid Ironman for 4 years. This year, Pond treated more than 300 racers. He sent 30 people to the hospital, some with internal bleeding. One man was in intensive care for 8 hours.
He actually ended up having fluid in his lungs, had a GI bleed. He was extremely sick. Electrolytes were messed up.
In September, an athlete died from a heart attack during a triathlon in Santa Cruz, California. The Ironman is so punishing, Pond says, that physicians often see the human body reacting in ways they don't understand. Pond once treated a racer who actually went blind.
The clear part of his eyes was completely clouded over. It was actually gray or silver. So you could see no color, no pupil. I said, my God, this is X-Files. The guy's an alien. And I said, you know, can you see light, dark? Can you see these two fingers? No. I said, oh, this looks bad to me.
The condition cleared up over several days, and Pond still isn't sure what happened, possibly an extreme electrolyte imbalance. The strange thing, he says, is that ailments like these seem to strike randomly, hitting newcomers and veterans alike.
Come on in. You can leave the shoes on.
It's 3 months after the Ironman. Sandy Izzo is home in Lake Placid with her three kids.
Joey, where are you?
Izzo is 43 years old, and she's raced triathlons for more than a decade. She says the Ironman offers an escape from her duties as a mother and a housewife. Her bicycle sits on a stand in the dining room, surrounded by toys and piles of folded laundry.
I had no idea that as soon as my feet hit the ground off the bike, that everything would just fall apart.
On race day, back in July, Izzo drank more than 2 gallons of sports drink, but her body malfunctioned, shunting the fluid into her abdominal cavity.
It ended up leaching into my abdomen in areas where it shouldn't be. I was bloated, extremely bloated, and it was painful. I was really headed down a very serious and dangerous road, and I'm extremely thankful that I did get stopped.
Izzo says she almost didn't stop. With her body becoming seriously dehydrated, her brain began to shut down.
I don't remember a lot of the run, but I remember people starting to ask me if I was okay, and I started to answer no. And then we just run by and keep going. I probably should have been stopped.
If she's adamant about going, it's tough to stop someone.
Ironman USA's Shane Facteau.
Was she probably fogged out, it sounds like, a little bit, and was, you know, had a rough day? Yeah, but at the same time, she just competed for how many hours? 6.5 hours, right? Do you really want to be the one to tell her, no, you can't go?
That ethic pervades the Ironman. Supporters say it's all about individual athletes making tough choices under pressure. It's part of the drama, part of the sport's carefully crafted image. But Dr. Michael Pond, the race physician, says often up to a third of the athletes simply can't make sound decisions while racing triathlons.
There is not a good evaluation for capacity where these people can continue, and I think that is one of the areas of weakness or challenges to shore this up. Because clearly by the time some of these people get to the marathon, they're in trouble. You know, some of these people are just out to lunch.
Just before midnight, Lake Placid's Ironman is hit by a fierce storm. Except for flashes of lightning, it's pitch dark. The crowds have gone home, but the slowest athletes are still running. Jim Knapp from Bay Shore, Long Island, finishes after 16 and a half hours. With rain streaming down his forehead, he says the race was frightening.
A little bit there, you know, towards the end, because we were under the tree cover. I was afraid a tree would get hit.
Knapp says he never considered seeking shelter.
This is a little different, you know, this Ironman, you want to just finish.
Despite the lightning, Ironman officials chose not to shut down the race. In June, a windstorm hit the Ironman Triathlon in Provo, Utah, while athletes were in the water. One racer drowned. Dozens of others had to be rescued. Again, Shane Facto.
Utah was a freak thing. It really was. The wind came out of nowhere. We're just happy that in the end, the way the situation worked out, that we didn't have a bigger tragedy on our hands.
Accidents like these have triggered lawsuits across the country. Last month, the family of a triathlete killed in a bicycle crash in Virginia won $500,000 settlement from the town that sponsored the race. One of two major insurance companies currently covering triathlons has stopped accepting new clients, citing the high risk. But it's unlikely that threats of injury or even death will slow the sport's growth. For many athletes, danger is part of triathlon's mystique. 6 weeks after her disastrous race in Lake Placid, Sandy Izzo traveled to Wisconsin for another Ironman. This time, she says, she nearly drowned.
It was really rough to the point where I thought it could be really dangerous for somebody. And I did get beat up quite a bit, punched, pushed under, run over.
Will you do this again?
Probably. Yes.
The Hawaii Ironman, considered the sport's world championship, took place October 19th. The swim was so rough that many racers were treated for seasickness, but there were no reports of death or serious injury. The race will be broadcast nationally on NBC November 23rd. For Only a Game, I'm Brian Mann in Lake Placid.
You're listening to Only a Game.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Trader Joe's, a unique grocery store where buyers travel the world for products like smoked Atlantic salmon, non-alcoholic sparklers, and imported chocolate. More at TraderJoe's.com. A Street Frames, 21 years of frame making for galleries, artists, and the public, offering museum-quality framing and professional advice in Cambridge near Fresh Pond and in Boston's South End, AStreetFrames.com. And the Music Emporium of Lexington, supplying acoustic guitars, banjos, and mandolins to discerning musicians of all levels. The Music Emporium, fine fretted instruments for the music enthusiast. Good morning, I'm Gina Cervetti. In sports headlines, the Celtics' six-game winning streak is over. The unbeaten Dallas Mavericks downed the Celts 97-86 at the Fleet Center last night. Dallas is the NBA's only team that hasn't lost this season. Boston plays at Milwaukee tonight. The Boston Bruins were off last night. The Providence Bruins skated past Portland 6-5 in overtime. And the Patriots are preparing for tomorrow night's game against the Oakland Raiders. Both teams are 5-4 heading into the matchup. Join host Jackie Leiden on our next Citizens of the World tour to Vietnam this spring. Find out more about the trip by calling 800-909-9287. A nor'easter is moving into the region this weekend. Heavy rains, sleet, and snow today could make for dangerous driving. Little or no snow accumulation is expected, except in higher elevations. Up to 2 inches is possible there. Windy with temperatures in the 30s. And tonight, windy and rainy. Areas north of the Mass Pike could see some dangerous ice accumulation. Temperatures in the 40s.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, an ancient sport renewed in Virginia. But first, our analyst Charlie Pierce joins me on the line from Washington, D.C. to comment on the week's sports news. Hello, Mr. NASCAR.
Hey, I got a great setup this morning, Bill. Let me tell you that.
I'm delighted. Now, Tony Stewart has a chance to win the 2002 Winston Championship tomorrow at the Ford 400 in Florida. he would be a lot closer to the NASCAR title if not for a 25-point reduction following last Sunday's Checker Auto Parts 500 for an unapproved front suspension spring. It doesn't get any better than talk like this, does it?
Absolutely not. You know what I know about cars? Valet parking, $9. But I do know that Tony Stewart winning the title will do two things. Number one, it will make former Redskins coach Joe Gibbs a champion in two very uniquely different sports. And second of all, because Tony Stewart is a fairly standard issue 21st century sports jerk, it will give NASCAR's image as this kind of really press and fan-friendly operation a bit of a jolt of the real world.
Baseball, meanwhile, announced its most valuable players this week. Charlie, Barry Bonds won his fifth such trophy, and American leaguer Miguel Tejada snagged his first. Did anybody get jobbed?
You know, Bill, there are two sports arguments I never enter into. One is, who belongs in the Hall of Fame? Because, as you know, my standard answer is everyone. And the other one is, what does valuable and most valuable mean? But all I know is that when the one great scorer comes to write the history of baseball, Alex Rodriguez is going to be the greatest shortstop who ever played it. And sooner or later, the poor guy has got to win a Most Valuable Player award.
Citing the Boy Scouts and college fraternities, among other organizations, Hootie Johnson, under pressure to admit women to his golf club, claimed this week that the Augusta National was in good company. Any problems with that logic?
Well, this is one of those arguments that exists, I think, purely as an argument. If Hootie had managed to keep his mouth shut in the first place and not run amok with this letter sent to him by Martha Burke and announced that he was not going to end the gender discrimination at Augusta National, quote, at the point of bayonets, which is preposterous, by the way, you know, life would be a lot easier in this discussion. Does he have the right to keep Augusta National all male? Yes, he does. Is it stupid and immoral and unethical and culturally biased to do so in the year 2002? Absolutely. Is he drawing some sort of line in the sand? Yes. Why is he doing it? Nobody knows.
Serena Williams lost the WTA Championship in Los Angeles to Kim Clijsters. That was unlikely enough. Even more unlikely was Ms. Williams saying afterward, quote, I like that I didn't win because now I'm so motivated to win the Australian Open and all the tournaments after that. You don't think she tanked last Sunday's match, do you?
I don't think she tanked, but I also wouldn't underestimate the possibility that she might do exactly what she said she's going to do. If the Williams sisters had been scrabbling around for ways to be motivated, I think the rest of the tour should not be exactly grateful that they've managed to find one.
Meanwhile, Bob Knight, formerly of Indiana University, currently
of
Texas Tech, is suing his former employer for $2 million, saying that he was fired without cause and that he lost shoe contract and radio and TV money as a result of being fired. Didn't Indiana pay him enough, and isn't Texas Tech currently paying him enough?
Well, wasn't Bob Knight always the exemplar of responsibility and mature leadership and carrying the weight of your own action around? I mean, wasn't that part of his coaching philosophy? Look, I don't. The only thing that is interesting about this lawsuit is that prominent within it, of course, is Miles Brand, who was then the president of Indiana University mm-hmm. and terminated Knight's arrangement. Miles Brand is now the head of the NCAA. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure, both within the state of Indiana and within the hierarchy of college sports, to settle this thing quickly and quietly. And, of course, if they give Bob Knight a nickel, he'll declare victory from the tiny-sized podium he now has in Lubbock.
Just for clarification's sake, Indiana's given him a lot more than a nickel. They paid him off when
he
left.
Apparently they didn't arrange to have everyone else pay him off.
Right. Memphis Grizzlies head coach Sidney Lowe resigned on Tuesday, Charlie, after his team posted a stunning 0-8 start this season. Former TNT analyst Hubie Brown will lead the so far hapless team. Will the fact that Brown hasn't coached for 15 years be a problem here?
Well, I think it'll be less of a problem than the fact that even when he was coaching, Hubie Brown evinced an obvious belief that basketball would be better played by salt shakers on a checkered tablecloth or X's and O's on a board than by real human beings. He had trouble getting along with the athletes of the 60s and 70s.
Uh-oh.
I'm not entirely sure what he'll do with the athletes of the 90s and the aughts.
I wondered until this week whatever happened to Manute Bol, the 7'7" Sudanese who ended his 11-year NBA career back in 1996. And the answer is that he has signed a contract with the CHL's Indianapolis Ice. Is that the specter of Bill Veeck I see strolling upon the ramparts of minor league hockey?
That is the specter of Bill Veeck you see holding his sides and laughing in delight. Look, it would be very easy for us to get on our high horse and criticize Manute Bol for his assault on the essential dignity of minor league hockey, but let's not do that. Let's remember that he's doing this to raise money to help the victims of the Civil War in his native Sudan. And frankly, if he wants to put on big shoes and a rubber nose and dance at halftime in the Super Bowl for that cause, I don't have a problem with it.
Finally, Charlie, Penn State head coach Joe Paterno refused to comment this week on a referee doll that allegedly hung from the doorknob of his front door until Monday. The doll reportedly was there hanging by its neck and holding a little yellow flag, and I hadn't realized that Coach for Life Paterno was into voodoo.
This is unquestionably the strangest old coach story I've heard in a long time. Joe has been very vocal in his dislike for the various zebras that have been working his games over the last couple of years. I have no idea what action, if any, the Big Ten might take against Paterno and Penn State. First of all, because he's Joe Paterno and an icon, and second of all, because this is just nuts.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he hangs out with us each Saturday on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
On Wednesday, we received an email from Laura Brendan, who hears Only a Game on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio. "I was so disappointed this morning," she wrote. "You were beaten to the punch, to use a sports metaphor, by Morning Edition." Ms. Brendan had heard a Morning Edition story on jousting as Maryland's state sport. "Holding a lance steady enough to pluck a one-quarter-inch ring, well, I was in awe," she wrote, "but I wish I'd heard it from you." Sorry, Ms. Brendan, I guess we'll just have to expand on NPR's coverage with this report on the National Jousting Tournament from Only a Game's Karen Given.
On a cold and gray October day, dozens of horse trailers have lined up on either side of a grassy field in Purcellville, a small town in Northern Virginia's farm country. Three large wooden arches have been set into the ground, 20 yards apart on an 80-yard track, which will turn to mud by the end of the day. A small white tent has been raised to house a crackling sound system, a small cassette player, and just one cassette, with medieval music on one side and the national anthem on the other. Now, with a little pomp and circumstance, the national jousting finals can begin. Riders on horseback enter the field one by one, carrying the flags and banners of their local jousting clubs. Most are from Virginia and Maryland, and many are missing. Today marks the lowest attendance in years at the national finals, after rain left the track too soggy to use and the tournament had to be postponed. Still, aware that rain is scarce in farm country, no one complains.
"And Lord, even though many of us found it an inconvenience to change our date of this joust, thank you so very much for the precious rain that we received."
After the parade and prayers, veteran rider Leon Enfield offers the traditional charge to the lords and ladies.
"Today in this joust, ride hard, ride true, until the Sir Knight or the Fair Maid who has the strongest arm and the truest aim will go the spoils."
With all the talk of knights and maids, and even one brave rider in medieval garb, the casual observer might now expect the riders to don suits of armor and face each other across the field. Linda Minnick has been jousting for 35 years and has become the sport's unofficial historian. She says after a while, when medieval jousting tournaments lost too many riders, the sport changed and jousters began to ride against rings suspended from arches. And that's how the sport came to the United States.
It's a military thing that has come down through the ages, and where it became popular in this form was very prevalent after the Civil War. The Southern cavalry units, especially when they got together for reunions, the whole atmosphere of chivalry and so forth, and their horsemanship, this was an excellent way for them to compete and show off at the same time. So that's, and it's very true in these areas, especially in Maryland, which was not technically a Confederate state, where they're popular even today were areas that were pockets of Southern sympathizers.
Today, it might be said that jousting is in a bit of a slump. Spectators here are in short supply, consisting of just a few family members who have braved the cold to see the event. But in the 1970s, the national finals were held on the grounds of the Washington Monument, and hundreds dropped by to cheer on the riders. Minnick says the spectacle brought a temporary surge to the sport.
They got so excited, they brought their families in, and for about 15 years, we had a right good many. And then as the kids grow up and discover cars, you can always, you know, that's the hard part. We get them through the teen years, and they come back, we're okay.
As the event gets underway, Mona Banton from Buckingham County, Virginia, explains the finer points of the competition. Riders must make it through the track in 8 seconds or less, attempting to pick a 1-inch ring off each of the three arches with their steel-tipped lance. For a smoother ride, they pull their stirrups all the way up, like a jockey's, a stance that's punishing on the body.
See this guy, how he's up out of the saddle? And see all the forces on his knees. And he's not making time.
And that's a good start. Two rings.
Riders who don't make time on their first run are allowed a second chance. To determine a winner, the rings are incrementally reduced in size until they're just a quarter inch across. That's the size of a Lifesaver candy.
So if you can imagine a Lifesaver hanging on a pole on a horse that's running full speed, because you want them to run as fast as they will on this track, and this track today is fairly mushy. So it'll be a challenge.
Made of Northwind for the second ring only. You must make time. Charge when ready.
Jousters choose their names based on whatever takes their fancy. There are silly names like the Knight of, well, if I can, or I would if I could, and geographic names like the Knight of Glade Farm and the Maid of Midway. Riders are placed in competitive classes, not by age or even gender, but by skill. That's because Banton says it takes so long to get good.
First thing you do is you bring your horse out here and you submit him to, he's just an old country animal, and you submit him to all this stuff. It's a big ordeal. And then you bring him in here and you want him to run a straight line. So you get him all organized the first year. The second year, you're pretty well confident that your horse is doing pretty good and you can quit worrying about what he's going to do and concentrate on catching the rings. The third year, you put his skill and yours together and start winning tournaments.
As veteran rider Roger Campbell takes his fifth championship in what's called the professional class, the highest honor in jousting, George Gaudet, an orthopedic surgeon from Virginia, gets ready to compete in the amateur class. Gaudet has only been riding for 5 seasons, but he already considers his to be a jousting family.
I've got an 18-year-old who's been riding, and I got a 1-month-old who's already been up on Breeze, so I'm sure everyone's taking bets over there if my newborn will ride first or walk first, so I'm sure she'll ride first.
Kids as young as 3 and a half have been known to joust, though generally at much slower speeds, with one parent leading the horse and the other holding on to the child. At the far end of the field, the oldest member of one of jousting's biggest families watches over the tournament from his golf cart, like a king on a throne. With a red blanket draped over his badly broken leg, Leon Enfield is no stranger to the dangers of jousting. Before he was thrown from his horse earlier this season, Enfield had been jousting for 54 years and had never missed a national championship. As he surveys the jousters readying for their ride, he has no trouble imagining what's running through their heads.
When you sit there, you're thinking, when you're really riding tight, your stomach and your muscles are tight, you got butterflies, and as you turn to go up the track, you concentrate completely and totally on the rings.
And ladies and gentlemen, once again, Mr. Roger Campbell, the Knight of Ponderosa II,
at the end of the day, to the victor goes the sword. Roger Campbell is knighted with a sword that serves as the national trophy. And in a ceremony worthy of Hollywood, he places a wreath of flowers on his wife's head and crowns her as the queen of love and beauty. While his wife looks on from her throne-like chair, the day's winners line up to be similarly knighted. And none are more eager than the young children of the novice class. Today, there are more novice riders than any other class. And if their parents have anything to say about it, that means this sport will be around for many years to come. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Purcellville, Virginia.
And that wraps up our ceremony and our jousting tournament for 2004. We'd like to thank everyone for coming, for all the help. Please remember to disperse your horse manure. If you have any straw or hay...
Your Majesty, let me tilt with him and smite him! Don't refuse me so abruptly, I implore! Oh, give me the opportunity to fight him! And Gaul will be divided once more!
You will bash and thrash him?
I'll smash and mash him!
You'll give him trouble?
He will be rubble!
A mighty whack!
His skull will crack!
Well...
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Al Banks at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter or Cyberjoust. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from jouster George Gaudette, who introduces his horse, Arapaho Breeze III, to our own Karen Given.
Can you say hi to Karen? Hi, Karen.
Methinks yon jouster partaketh of the sweet mead in excess. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Give the uplinks of French order.
I do applaud your noble goals. Now let us see if you achieve them. And if you do, then you will be the three who will go to the ball, to the show.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
And this
Public Radio.
And this